This is the latest installment of Conducting Business, WQXR.org's podcast series on the classical music industry. I'm your host, Naomi Lewin. Don't let the harmonious strains of this Beethoven performance fool you. The collaboration was anything but pastoral. The conductor is Arturo Toscanini, who was known for his definitive way with Beethoven, but he was also known for his tantrums, which involved breaking batons, storming off stage, and even throwing scores at his musicians. Over the last 40 years or so, unionized musicians have fought for reasonable working conditions, and autocratic conductors like Toscanini have become increasingly outmoded, or so it seemed. Some high-profile cases of conductors behaving badly, yes or no, have cropped up again recently in the news. Three guests are joining me for a look at the clout of the conductor today. On the line, Norman Lebrecht, author of several books, including The Maestro Myth and Why Mahler, which is about to come out in paperback. Hello, Norman.
Hi, Naomi.
And Anne Majette, the classical music critic of The Washington Post. Hello, Anne.
Hi, Naomi.
And here in the studio with me is Jesse Rosen, president and CEO of the League of American Orchestras.
Hey, Naomi.
Recently, Roberto Minchuk, the director of the Brazilian Symphony Orchestra, caused a furore when he asked tenured musicians in his orchestra to submit to evaluation auditions. Also, Mark Gorenstein, music director of the Svatlanov Orchestra in Russia, was fired last week after he made an ethnic slur about a cello soloist at the Tchaikovsky competition this summer. So, Norman, you have covered those stories very closely on your blog. Are these aberrations, or do they suggest something more deeply rooted about the continued power of conductors today?
Well, Naomi, I think something is shifting here. I broke those stories and gave them the kind of international attention they would never have got before the current age of social media, so that people in really quite remote places of the world, in Brazil and in Russia, who would not normally have the means of communication, musicians had the means of communication and had the means of sending through me evidence of what was going on, so that when Roberto Minchuk, who got into conflict with his orchestra by demanding to fire a lot of the players after they refused to attend a re-audition for their jobs, basically to sing for their supper or get no supper at all, when he was booed in a concert, there were people there videoing that concert, sending it to me, and for me to put it up on my Arts Journal blog slip disc, and from that, you know, tens of thousands of people around the world to see that there was a situation developing at the Brazil Symphony Orchestra, and then a growing musician's boycott of that orchestra, which followed, which resulted in Minchuk having to step down, both from his policy and from his main positions, and a more equitable, reasonable settlement to be reached with the senior musicians. What happened in Russia was a similar thing. Mark Gorenstein had a certain reputation among musicians in his orchestra and rather wider. It came to light during the Tchaikovsky competition when he was very abusive towards one of the contestants. He used a term that could be construed as racial abuse, and because the Tchaikovsky competition was, for the first time this year, totally transparent, out there, live, online, visible to anyone, that clip of video was on YouTube in no time, and the whole world knew about it. Valery Gergiev and Richard Rodzinski, conductor and son of a conductor who were running the competition, acted very promptly and creditably and removed Gorenstein from the competition. His orchestra, his own orchestra, then took that opportunity to rebel against him. The long and the short of it was he was fired at the end of last week. For what I'm hearing, both from the Brazilians and from the Russians and from elsewhere in the music world, is that this sort of thing couldn't have happened before. We are actually witnessing a kind of Arab Spring among orchestral musicians that is facilitated by such things as Google and Facebook and YouTube and Twitter.
I want to return to the Brazilian thing in just a moment, but first I want to ask you, Jesse, your organization represents American orchestras. Could incidents like this happen here in this country, and what kind of safeguards are there in place to keep conductors from running the show like that?
Yeah.
I think it's interesting that the examples cited are all from Brazil and Russia. In the United States, very unlikely to happen now, partly because of the musician contracts, which really make it practically impossible to capriciously and arbitrarily dismiss a musician. The other thing I would say is that, you know, your example about Toscanini, you know, that was at a time when command and control was still the principal organizational design in the United States. And since that time, command and control has given way in many places to alternative notions of what leadership means. And the concept of servant leadership is now much more ascendant in the United States. And those values around how you lead have really changed throughout the United States. So both from a cultural and a value standpoint, I think people leading American orchestras are far less likely to act that way. And even if they did, then I think there are tremendous safeguards built into the collective bargaining agreements that would make it very difficult to pull that off.
And a healthy ego would seem like a job requirement for a conductor. Are the safeguards in this country enough to keep the power of conductors reined in?
Oh, I think obviously a healthy ego is a requirement. I think there have been incidents, individual incidents like this throughout the history of conducting. I think the prevalence of social media, as Norman indicates, makes it possible to focus on individual moments and spotlight them in a way that was not possible in the era of Toscanini, of George Sell. There are so many stories about conductors acting imperious in the past. But a lot of these are simply things that one sees in interpersonal relationships in many settings where there are people in control and hierarchies and bosses who behave unreasonably. I don't think it's as absent in America as Jesse says either. There was a conductor at an orchestra in Texas, which I'm madly trying to Google right now, his name I can't remember, who behaved unconscionably toward the orchestra and led to a mass resignation and ultimately to his own firing, and that was within the last 10 years. The benefit is that social media curb bad behavior. The downside is that they blow it up out of proportion. And it's unconscionable for a conductor to make an ethnic slur during rehearsal. There's no question about that. It's a good thing that we can stop that. But to devolve it into a talk about the excesses of the conductor's ego and, you know, how can we stop this and what safeguards are in place, basically, there are jerks in every facet of our lives, and we should try to curb them when we can, and any tool we can use to curb them is great. I don't think it's a problem just for conductors, and I think that conductors as a breed have grown far tamer and far more collegial as a philosophical approach rather than out of fear of being condemned in the last decades. I think we've seen it all over the world.
Okay, on the subject,
I disagree with Jesse that it can't happen in the United States and it won't happen in the United States. I think it already is. Musicians are using social media. Conductors are using social media. And situations will develop, especially with the looming bankruptcies at Philadelphia, at Colorado, and others, where I think dissident and powerful views will be expressed, and the old manner of managing orchestras, both from an administrative point of view and from a conducting point of view, will be, if not overturned, at least very, very shaken.
I think, you know, talking about conductors versus talking about managers is two different things. If you look at the Detroit Symphony strike, which was one of the most painful and disruptive occurrences in American orchestras in recent times, Leonard Slatkin didn't behave any differently, and is not behaving any differently now toward his orchestra than he was before the strike. You may say a lot about the management, but the conductors aren't, as far as I can tell, playing a role. And, you know, in some sense, to me, a more profound question is not where does the power and authority lie. The question is, how does an orchestra and its body of musicians collectively find some way to deal with the need for continual improvement? And the systems that we have are basically defensive systems as opposed to proactive systems that allow there to be dialogue, conversation, feedback between conductors and musicians, and musicians and musicians themselves. And so we're starting out with a very rigid template for how all of this works. It's not predicated on how do you strengthen the quality of performance in an orchestra, but how do you protect people from abusive behavior? It's not that that doesn't matter, but that's only one piece of the equation. I think orchestras would do much better to design practices that allow for feedback from peers and feedback between conductors and musicians.
Now, on the subject of social media and Brazil particularly, and whether social media is something that improves the situation or inflames the situation, Norman, I have to say that I have it from a reliable source that the orders for these auditions and all of this in Brazil came from above Minchik. He doesn't pay the musicians. This was all something that was done in order to raise the level of the orchestra for the upcoming Olympics. Minchik is also music director of the Calgary Philharmonic, and he has not done anything similar there. So, in this instance, do you think maybe that you jumped the gun or that you pointed the gun at the wrong culprit?
I don't think so. In fact, as soon as I published, the second thing that I published was a letter to me from Minchuk stating his position. So I was very conscious of giving both sides, giving the musician side and giving Minchuk's side and indeed giving the administration side. A senior member of the administration came to see me here in London. We discussed the various options and again, I was able to reflect their views as I was everyone else's. I mean, I was functioning here, or my site was functioning here, chiefly as a message board. And eventually, thankfully, I'm so pleased about it, to reach an equitable solution. In the matter of how responsible Roberto Minchuk was, clearly he was the one who communicated the new policy to the musicians. From what the musicians were saying, and indeed from his original letter to me, it was pretty apparent that he agreed with it. You can't at one moment stand for a policy and then retreat from it. So I think, you know, he's music director. He is supposed to be in charge of auditions. He's supposed to be in charge of this sort of thing. I don't think the rumor mill can allow him to escape from that.
And what is your
view? Well, the rumor mill, I mean, it's a tricky position because everybody, the truism about orchestras is that you have 100 players and 105 opinions. So as soon as orchestras are given a public forum, you're going to hear a lot of strong opinion on both sides. And, you know, one of the differences between blogging and print journalism, which you and I both favor and exploit, is that blogging is a forum for discussion. As you said, it becomes a kind of message board and a place for people to talk to each other. And print journalism becomes one's best attempt to get the whole story and a rounded picture of it. This, I think, can be a slightly dangerous thing in the case of orchestras because a lot of musicians with a beef can become a very potent and yet possibly one-sided weapon against a conductor. There have been other conductors who wanted to re-audition orchestras. Goodness knows, Ivan Fischer and the Budapest Festival Orchestra, I believe he re-auditions everybody every 2 years. And one handicap to him taking over an American orchestra is the impossibility of him doing the same under American union regulations. So it's a nuanced question, and the function of a blog in the debate is different than the function of a print article.
I agree with you entirely, Anne. I think they are mutually compatible. In this matter of the re-audition, some very interesting things have arisen in recent months. For instance, I was told that there is a process of constant re-audition at the Seoul Philharmonic Orchestra. I discussed it with their conductor, Myung-Wong Chung, and indeed with a couple of the players, and what emerges is that there's a very, very sophisticated method of allowing players who have passed their best to develop other skills within the orchestral organization so that they may no longer be playing frontline concerts, they may be playing what they call neighborhood concerts, but they're kept within the organization as mentors to the new players who are coming in, to the young players who are coming out of college, or indeed many of whom are coming back from Europe from conservatories and going straight into the orchestra. So that's a much more humane way of dealing with it than was being practiced in Brazil. I hear, for instance, at the Czech Philharmonic, they're about to start a process of re-auditions under their new music director, Jiří Belolavik. This isn't about re-auditions. It's about multiple voices, which is what an orchestra ought to be. That one is no longer hearing just from the conductor or just from the administration or just from the deputy PR director. the results of social media, and it's not something that we can turn off like a tap. The presence of social media means that multiple voices will be heard, and those multiple voices will, I think, be of benefit in creating a better musical environment.
One hopes, but the risk is that the multiple voices can turn around and bully somebody. There's a real risk of mobbing, which is always a risk when multiple voices turn up, that, you know, somebody becomes unfairly the target of a kind of mass vindictive streak.
You mean the conductor?
Yeah, it's true. I mean, you hire a conductor to be in charge.
And let's take the situation of Mark Gorenstein. He's not somebody that I know, and I'm guessing that he's not somebody that you know.
No, I believe that Mark Gorenstein and Roberto Minshuk in these cases are apples and oranges. As I said, Mark Gorenstein acted like a jerk, and how great that it was possible through social media to immediately realize he was a jerk.
When somebody acts like a jerk, they're probably not a one-off jerk.
Absolutely, I agree completely.
They are probably a generic jerk who have acted like that before and continue to act like that.
This is why social media is so great that it can catch it.
In the Tchaikovsky competition, in front of the world's cameras, or rather in front of the organization's live cam, then players in the orchestra started communicating with me and telling me of the way that he comported himself towards them, that they would be fined a week's wages or 2 weeks' wages for turning up 2 minutes late. Now, if you're a musician in the Svetlanov Orchestra in Russia, a week's wages means your kids don't eat.
Sure. No, you get no argument
to me
that he was a jerk.
And for a conductor to be behaving like that in 2011 is totally unacceptable.
Can we take this in a slightly different direction at this point? Now, I want to bring up Fabio Luisi, which is a completely different kettle of fish, but still a kind of instance of interesting, for lack of a better word, conductor behavior. Fabio Luisi recently canceled a lot of his fall schedule in Europe so that he could substitute for an ailing James Levine at the Metropolitan Opera in New York. The Rome Opera posted a statement on its website condemning Luisi's actions, and they're apparently considering legal action. And companies in Vienna and Genoa, where Luisi was supposed to conduct, complained publicly in the press. Is this a case of conductor power or just a combination of maybe bad timing and questionable manners?
I think to link these three things together is like apples and oranges and grapefruit. Not even grapefruit. What's less likely? I mean, these are three instances.
We're going to run out of
greengrocers. Exactly. Conductors, you know, behaving in certain ways. Fabio Luisi got the chance of a lifetime to take over the Met, or to possibly take over the Met, to certainly get a title there. Of course he jumped at it. Of course he stepped on toes on the way. It's unfortunate. I recently had to choose between two attractive gigs, and I had to cancel one at the last minute. Those people weren't happy either. This happens in the business world.
It happens to everyone. And Naomi, if you're asked tonight to present nightly news on NBC, you're going to say, no, my first loyalty is WQXR. You'll never budge me from here.
Oh, don't worry. I don't like doing television. I would never say yes to TV.
There we go, the idealism. But, you know,
I agree with Anne here. I don't think these things are analogous. The Met not only made Fabio Luisi an offer he was hard-pressed to refuse, but it also said to those other organizations, we're going to take him and you can't do anything about it. The Met was really high-handed about this, and Luisi went along with it. What he did do, though, and where he did stick to his guns, was to say, I am the new music director of the opera in Zurich, and that is going to come first, regardless of whatever else the Met are going to throw at me. So for the moment, and the Met may have promoted me from principal guest conductor to principal, but my number one priority is with Zurich. That's where it goes. I will cancel some guest conducting in order to accommodate the Met in their time of crisis, because let's not mince words, it is most definitely a crisis, but my priorities are number one, Zurich, number two, the Met.
Okay, so Norman, in your book, The Maestro Myth, you write about a great conductor as a mythical hero, artificially created for non-musical purpose, sustained by commercial necessity, and you say that the conductor exists because we need a visible leader or at least an identifiable figurehead. How much are conductors these days important as figureheads and fundraisers?
Naomi, I think if you look at the publication date on the Maestro Myth, you will find that it was published exactly 20 years ago. So things have changed since then. What that book did was to look at the nature of the use and abuse of power in conducting, which is something nobody had actually done before, to look at the conductor as a leadership figure in society as well as in the music world, and to examine how that was actually affecting the music making and how it was affecting the generality of what you call in this podcast the conducting business. How has it changed? It's changed enormously. 1.5 generations have passed since then. And when I look at the younger conductors, the ones in their 30s, the ones who read the Maestro myths at college or before they went to college, they have a very, very different approach to the act of conducting, to their duties and responsibilities as conductors, and to their ambitions. And it's a much healthier approach, I find.
I would just say it's not limited to 30-year-olds. I mean, even an appointment like Ricardo Muti in Chicago. Muti, I think to many people's surprise, launched his tenure there with a very broad-based commitment and expression of concern for the community of Chicago and how he could use his role to improve and deepen the orchestra's connection to its community. So for the first time, you have their composers in residence at the Chicago Symphony doing work in prisons in Chicago. The Chicago Symphony launched this whole citizen musician initiative, which came under Muti's overarching vision, but it was actually implemented by staff and Yo-Yo Ma working on behalf of the orchestra. So, you know, from a role standpoint, I think the notion of musical leadership has broadened considerably among American music directors. And even when those music directors may not have a particular aptitude or interest or skill in some of that kind of work, you see orchestras going to other types of expertise to help fulfill that particular aspect of leadership in their communities.
How about a conductor's manner on stage?
I absolutely agree. Muti is a changed man in Chicago, unrecognizable from the person that he was in Philadelphia 2 decades ago.
How so?
He's talking a different language. He's acting in a different way. Muti, when he was very young, was hugely influenced by the personality and conduct of Arturo Toscanini. When he conducted in London in the 1970s, he was pretty tyrannical with the orchestra. And when he came to Philadelphia in the 80s, a lot of that was still there. I am the music director. What I say goes. This is what we're going to perform. This is how I'm going to comport myself. And this is what the orchestra is going to be doing. He was absolutely authoritarian. I think a lot of that rubbed off through his experience in Philadelphia, which was not a happy experience. I think he learned a tremendous amount being director at La Scala. And when he finally took Chicago, having been offered New York and rejected it, I think, and this is no more than supposition and observing his conduct, I think he said to himself, I'm going to do this as a different person. I'm going to do it as a new man.
Well, let me add here that this is a reflection of a change in our perception of what is important from a conductor, that Muti's behavior clearly reflects that music is not the only measuring stick by which a conductor is judged. Now, 50 years ago, one of the reasons that so much bad behavior was excused, or 60 years ago or 70 years ago, is the idea that we are all in the service of making great music. So if George Sell terrifies us all, that's okay because the product of these fantastic concerts. Today, a music director can't get away with that. He has to do the meet and greet. He has to be a social animal. He has to work with his orchestra. These are all factors that are important. And if he doesn't measure up, as many of these, you know, old school conductors are seeing, he will be mercilessly exposed on social media and in the press.
I think also conductors of the new generation are much less political than their predecessors. The older conductors were always very careful. They were looking over their shoulders. They took care not to invite guest conductors who might somehow show up their weaknesses or possibly even unseat them. And now we look at somebody like Gustavo Dudamel, who appoints Lionel Branquier, who is 5 years younger than him, highly talented, as his principal conductor in Los Angeles, and who is nurturing and mentoring a whole host of young Venezuelan conductors who are now taking up posts in Europe. I think conducting has become a much more collaborative, collegial enterprise. It's a much healthier field, and for all that, a more interesting field.
The only thing I would add to that, I think in almost every instance, the music director needs a really strong partner at the administrative level. And the scope of what's happening in Los Angeles in creating their own version of El Sistema. Their Youth Orchestra LA program is a very elaborate project. It involves, you know, dozens of staff members, hundreds of volunteers, partnerships with associations throughout Los Angeles. So I think in any one of these instances, and go back to the beginning, whether it's a conductor behaving badly or a conductor doing extremely well and advancing the art form and the orchestra's role in their community, having strong partnership in the top administrative position is really critical.
We've been using the pronoun he with reference to conductors, which is by and large the case. But, of course, there are also now some very strong women conductors at top orchestras. Do you think that that is changing? I've never heard of a female conductor behaving badly, but maybe that's because there aren't as many of them. Do you think that will change the landscape?
I think it already is changing the landscape. I'll probably be shot for making this generalization, but I think the leadership style of women that I've observed tends to be almost by, you know, just natural, I don't know if the a gender stereotype, but they tend to be more nurturing, and there's a more of a partnering, we're in this together, how can I be of help to you? That's not limited to women conductors, but I think from a temperamental standpoint, that's something that I've seen.
And you're there very close to Baltimore in Maren Alsop's territory. What do you have to say about this?
Well, Maren Alsop has become the poster child for women leading orchestras. She's the only one. There's Joanne Faletta, there's Maren Alsop. I hope to see more women coming into the field. I'm dismayed at the glacial pace it's taking. While I'm happy to see talented younger women, I think this is a whole different can of worms. I was just on the jury of the International Conducting Competition in Besançon, France, and of the 19 finalists out of 230 or 240 entrants, one was a woman of the 19. You know, that was what there was. But it's unfortunate that there aren't more.
I think that will be the great subject for our next or for another of our podcasts here. You've been listening to Conducting Business, WQXR.org's podcast series on the classical music industry. Our guests have been Norman Lebrecht, author of several books, including The Maestro Myth and Why Mahler, which is coming out in paperback this month, and Majette, who is the classical music critic of The Washington Post, and Jesse Rosen, President and CEO of the League of American Orchestras. I'm your host, Naomi Lewin. Our producer is Brian Weiss, and the engineer, Jason Isaac. Thank you very much for listening.